Psalm page 8.
Your soul, Bhagawa, Arahang Sama Sambuddho, Sovakato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo, Supatipanno Yassa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Dhammayang Bhagavantang Sadhammang Sasangang Ime hi sakare hi yatavahang Avopite hiyabhi pujayama sadhu no bhante bhagava suchiva vidhi bhukhubhi pachima janata nukampamanasa ime sakave Dugata pana kala bhute patikan hatu amhaka dikhavata hitaya sukhaya arahang sama sambuddho bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vichacharanasampanno Sukhato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhammasavati Sa Devamanusanang Buddho Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhi Pujayami Hang Bhagavantang Sivasa Namami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatak veditapo vinyuhi tamahang dhammang abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sivasa Namami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Iyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yadidang Chattari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasa Namami.
Normally, there's no more bowing. And we do the Metta Sutta in English.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Excellent. So, now there's, I'm going to say there's no box this evening, so, there is. Okay, very good. Here we go. Now try and be faster.
Okay, question number one. Oh, okay. My mother passed away recently. I understand that death is part of life, etc., but I still feel this immense overwhelming grief. Do you have any advice that can help me? And hopefully that you've all heard about that piece of advice when my father passed away. And I think I told that story already, didn't I? Are you on this retreat?
No.
No, yeah, okay. When my father passed away, I was only 16, and I've told many stories about him, just had a very wonderful father, very happy to have had him for those 16 years. But when he died, I never cried. And I've never cried at his funeral in Mortlake Cemetery in West London. I've never cried since whenever I think about him. And for me, being a young man, it was strange. Why, we love somebody so much, that when he dies, why don't you cry? And it took many years as a monk for me to understand how I felt. And of course, I used similes to understand my emotions, because the emotion I felt at my father's death, and every time I remember it, was similar to another emotion which I often felt as a young man growing up in London. And it led me to develop the simile of the concert. I love music, and I had all the opportunities to listen to some of the greatest musicians, you know, from classical music to jazz music, you know, remember Miles Davis and, yeah, Robbie Coltrane. Yeah, it's just amazing, just some of the musicians I managed to go and see. And of course, you know, the rock music with Mick Jagger and for the Rolling Stones when I was only 11, and to see the very first concert of Led Zeppelin and just going over into this pub with my brother, you know, I wasn't a monk, just growing up. Went into this upper story of a pub, and then it was this band playing, and there's only six people turned up to watch, and the lead singer was a gentleman called Rod Stewart. So these people became really famous later on in their life. Well, I remember those great concerts, you know, really inspiring music. And at the end of the concert, you know, we'd always
stand up, clap, and shout for more, 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 the encore. And that was the first thing which linked me to my father's death, because he was a very sick man, and he, many times, you know, he came very close to death, but he pulled through, almost like gave an encore for his family. But then came the time when he really did die. Just like in a concert, the musicians have to finally finish, and they pack up their instruments and go home. And so did I. And even though that some of those musicians and bands, you know, they would continue on to, you know, give other concerts next year, the year afterwards, but you know, it's never the same. And I knew that when those musicians had packed up their instruments, they were gone forever. I'd never hear that music in that situation again. Just like when my father died, he'd gone. The concert was over. And when I walked out of those halls and auditoriums and Albert Halls and places, then when I walked out, I always remember the London evenings. Well, they weren't really wet, they were like drizzle. If you think this is miserable weather here because it's a bit cold and wet, in London, it's always cold. It never really rains properly. It's just drizzle. And even the name, whoever invented that word drizzle, it was a word which totally fat the experience. It was grey, miserable, half-hearted. If it's going to rain, pour down. If you're not going to rain, just be dry. But it's halfway in between drizzle and cold. And go out miserable. But, even though I went out into the cold, dark, drizzly London night, I never felt depressed at the end of a great concert. I never sort of cried that the concert was over. I just participated and listened to some of the greatest music I'd ever heard. You know that that nun, Venerable Chanda, over in London, I'm trying to support, get a monastery for. And she, as soon as she heard that sort of I went to that first concert of Led Zeppelin, that when she, you know, she's much younger than I am, and that's where she used to go. That was her favourite band. And when I started saying, they said, oh, you're so lucky. But I never felt sad when the concert was over. I felt that I was blessed by going to an amazing performance. And that was precisely what I felt at the end of a great concert, at the end of my father's death. It was the end of a beautiful concert. Instead of, you know, just crying at his cremation, I felt like getting up and clapping. Bravo! Wonderful performance. I'll always remember that, and I always do. And that was actually where I changed, somehow or other, the whole perception of when somebody dies. To this day, I never take that as a loss, as a gain. I had that father for 16 years. As a gain. Not a loss. Yeah, I'd love to have him for 20 years, 40 years, 80 years. Just sometimes wonder what he would say now if he saw me, sort of being a Buddhist teacher with a bald head. But still, I'm sure he'd be incredibly proud of me. But when I think of him, I think of what a wonderful person that was to have that beginning part of my life. Thank you so much, Father. I never felt sad. I felt blessed, grateful that I had it for that long. So what grief is? Grief is focusing on what's been taken away. Gratitude, appreciation, love is remembering what you've had. So your mother passed away. How many years did you enjoy being the son or daughter of your mother? How many great memories has she left you with? You haven't lost a mother, you've gained one for all those years. And that turns the whole thing around. Yeah, death is part of life. But don't make negativity and focusing on what's been taken away part of life. Focus on what you've had. Beautiful time together. Thank you so much. And you'll never forget that. And that means you don't cry. You don't feel sad. And strange as it may seem, but in that part of Thailand where I spent 9 years, in the northeast of Thailand, it would qualify as an indigenous culture, Buddhist for generations. And because where that monastery was situated, it was the local cremation ground. So we'd see funerals every 3 or 4 days. It was where the villagers would come to do their funeral rites. And you see those villagers, you know, would go to the house when somebody had died and do some chanting there, and go the day afterwards, and they give you a big feast, and you'd see them the next mornings and weeks on arms round. So you knew those villagers, and they never cried at the funeral. I never saw a tear. You were right there with them at the funeral service and afterwards. And that was actually quite striking. It was a society without grief. And they didn't need to. Yeah, they missed their father, their mother, their wife, their grandparent, or whatever it was. Yeah, they missed them. But they also remembered just how long they were blessed with that person in their life. Thank you so much. A different way of looking at things. And that's what insight and wisdom is. You see things in a different way. And when you see things in a different way, wow. You don't need to have that sort of misery. If you want to cry, fine. We don't stop anybody, but, you know, is that really necessary? So, each one of you here, when you die, do you want people to cry at your funeral service? Do you?
No.
So, well, why do you cry at other people's? Hypocrites. A lot of it is because, please excuse me, some social pressure. You know, if you don't cry at your, say your wife's funeral, then they think, what, are you trying to get rid of her? Are you happy she's gone now? So that's why some societal pressure sometimes makes people feel sad. But why? Don't need to. Let it pass, let it go. And I think I remember why I thought I told that story, because on Friday, I did a little funeral service. The other story, which sometimes helps, was in old days, if you were going from Hong Kong to Australia, or even to Malaysia or Singapore, you'd go in a boat, no aircraft. At least in those days, you didn't get jet lag. You get seasickness instead. But anyway, that you would stand on the quayside, on the dock, and you see these big boats, and your son. Oh no, not someone else. Your father was on the deck. And you'd see him waving at you, saying goodbye, and you're on the dock, you know, just waving at them. And then the ship, you know, would sound the horn, and then the ship would actually start sailing away, so slowly, away from the port. And you'd see them, you wouldn't move. You'd actually be waving at them, maybe waving, you see you soon, yeah, don't forget to write or come back or see you later, whatever you shout out at a person who's so important for you in your life. And then that ship goes further away, so you can't hear them anymore, but you can just sort of see them on the deck. And as it goes further away, you can't make out just one passenger from another passenger, some grey smear on the deck. You know, one of those little spots there is the person who's so important for you in your life. And as it goes further away, you're still standing on the dock and you can just see the ship, a grey spot in the distance. And then you get to that point called the horizon. And that's where the ship just goes over the horizon and you can't see it anymore. For you never assume that the person who's on that boat, who sailed away, has disappeared. You know that there's something left, but you can't see them or touch them or feel them or hear them anymore. And that's like the horizon, the line between this life and the next life. They haven't really gone. They're just out of reach. And maybe later on you'll take that journey. Different way of looking at things. And anyway, to prove there is life after death. Oh, there's this, the story I said yesterday about the Australian going in the castle with the guide. How long you've been living in this castle? 300 years. It was a ghost. But this is a true story. That was not a true story. This one is a true story. It was a Sri Lankan who got very bad cancer, and they took her to Singapore, to the hospital there, and her sister, you know, was a good supporter of mine. So the sister called one evening and said, "Look, you know, my sister is right next to me in hospital. She's really sick. You know, there's no cure. She's dying. Can you just say a few words to her, Ajahn Brahm, just to counsel her? I know you can't come to Singapore to look after her, but, you know, at least you can say a few words." So I said a few words to her. You know, she obviously couldn't speak at all because, you know, she was paralyzed and just so weak. And so I gave her some advice about what happens when you die and just how to let go and that remember all the beautiful things you've done in your life, you know, the standard things. And then the next day I did the same, and the third day I did the same. The fourth night that her sister, you know, the healthy one, just didn't call at all. So I assumed that she must have died that day. And of course I was correct. The next day her sister called and said, "Yeah, my sister died last night. But," she said, "I need to tell you something," which is really weird. About, I forget exactly the amount of hours, 8 hours, 10 hours after she passed away, her sister who was dead sent her an email and said, "Thank you so much and please thank Ajahn Brahm." And that was after she had died. And there's no way she could have put in that email, you know, while she was in the bedside in the bed in Singapore, because she was paralyzed. And it was a message from beyond the grave. And that is the true part of the story. Sometimes I just cannot take things seriously. This is my character. So I say, from that time on, I started to understand what Gmail meant. Ghost mail. That's a true story. It's amazing that it was, she sent that email after she passed away. Interesting. Anyway, so that's overwhelming grief. No, you don't really feel grief. It's just, you feel this wonderful sweet and sour yeah, you miss them, but you also thank you so much for being my son, my daughter, a wonderful person in my life. I'll never forget that. And you don't forget it. Stays in you, those memories of people you love. How to let go of past and future thought by being kind to them. How should your kindness to past and future thought allow to focus on the present by focusing on the breath? Okay, you know that sometimes we have some memory in the past. What memories do you keep? The bad ones. Weird, isn't it? The good memories, what happened? You don't obsess so much with those. So now comes one of the grosser stories, but it's taught by Ajahn Chah. He taught me this story about the two chicken farmers. Two chicken farmers. The first chicken farmer got up early in the morning and went into the chicken shed to actually collect the produce of the night before. He took in a basket, bigger than this, and he filled the basket full of chicken shit and brought it back into the house. Where it made a big stink in the house. It was a very sort of, you know, mentally challenged chicken farmer. Chicken, and I'll tell you the meaning of this in a moment. Chicken farmer number two went into the shed with the basket and he filled the basket full of eggs. He left the dung in the shed to rot. It would become valuable fertilizer later, but you don't bring it into the house with you. Bring the eggs into the house. So he could make a nice omelette for his family's breakfast and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That's a smart chicken farmer. So Ajahn Chah would tell that story and then he would explain it. When he said, just like most people, when they collect the produce of their past, they put into their basket, called their memory, the shit. And they bring that home with them. All the bad memories of missing their flight, not getting their visa, being tired, losing their baggage, all the other stuff, the eggs, they leave in the past to rot. So, be honest. When you remember the past, you remember all those experiences when you were a kid or, you know, with your wife, your husband, just the last week. What do you put in your basket and you take home with you? Are you an egg collector or a shit collector? And it's amazing just when you say it like that. It's a bit coarse, but it makes a point. You find most of us, you know, we collect the poo of life. You know, you have a wonderful day and your husband says one thing which is, you know, upsets you. And that's all you remember. Why do you say that? Your wife is a tiny bit late. She spends a bit too much on the credit card and you'd never let her forget that. That's a tiny bit of poo. Remember this one husband, he told me that, you know, that even though his wife spent so much on the credit card, he decided, you know, for her birthday to pay for plastic surgery, which meant cutting up the credit cards. But that's so when you look at your past and all the negative things we remember, which is quite biased, frankly, then we're kind enough to remember the good parts too. If that person who harmed you, I don't know why he did that, or she did that, but give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they were just having a bad day. Maybe they said the wrong words, they didn't mean it. Maybe they did mean it, but they thought they were being funny. Whatever it was, don't be the prosecuting attorney. Be the defense attorney for them. The same with you when you feel guilty. You've done something wrong. Don't be sort of so critical of yourself. Give yourself a break. We all make mistakes. When I first took over, when Ajahn Chakra, my predecessor, sort of left, I decided I should really just give it my all to be a teacher in this monastery. And so even just after 1 or 2 weeks, I was walking around Bodhinyana Monastery just by the main hall when I found that I found this hammer lying in the grass getting rusty. And I thought, this is really unacceptable. Because, every one of you, sometimes you put a donation in the box, and that's where the hammer comes from. In those days, we didn't have many supporters in this monastery. And so, that some insensitive monk, careless monk, had left this hammer out in the rain. And I don't know who actually donated that hammer, but it had to teach the monks to respect the fact that you live on charity. You don't buy this yourself, but it could have been from some rich person, but more likely for some poor person who decided to collect a bit of cash and to get a hammer so the monks could build this monastery. And so I went in that evening, I called a meeting, and I gave a talk. It's not just, the nice, jokey talks like Ajahn Brahm does these days. I really blasted them. It was just like Margaret Thatcher, just as a monk. It was just really haranguing them, saying, this is not to be done, this is wrong, you shouldn't do this, you should respect charity, because as many people lose faith in religions, because monks, they think they deserve to be looked like royalty and have expensive things, and then they don't look after them, and that's not on. I was really fierce. And I know I must have been fierce because afterwards all the monks were sitting dead straight. Their body language was telling me maybe I'd overdone it. And then I just asked, who did that? No one monk confessed. And that was so much disappointing me. Because I thought, well, at least someone should actually own up it was them. And I thought as I walked out that maybe I was too fierce with them. Maybe I just was, they were too afraid of the consequences. And I walked out really disappointed. Because honesty and just, confessing you did something wrong, at least, that's a start to training. And as I walked out the hall, I understood why none of the monks confessed that it was them who left the hammer out in the rain. After giving them a lecture, only then did I remember that it was me. I totally forgot about it. I always meant I was going to come back later and pick it up and put it away. And all the time I was blaming others, I just could not see that it was me who actually did it. So it was embarrassing, but it was fun. Because I always remember this story and I tell it to other people. I'll turn around, went into the hall. Can you please sit down for a few moments, monks? I remember who left the hammer out. It was me. So after blaming and really cajoling and haranguing all these other people, that was so embarrassing. But welcome to being a human being. We make mistakes and sometimes that. So I'm kind to my past. When I make a mistake, I tell people about it. Even today, somebody came up to me because their father or mother was very sick in hospital, and they wanted to get some chanting. And I told them that there's many types of chanting. What chanting do you want? Because that time when I went to see this elderly Chinese man, who was dying in the ICU in the Royal Perth Hospital. And his whole family were there. They'd come from Taiwan, they'd come from Hong Kong, they'd come from mainland China. It was obviously, they were thinking this was going to be his last time on earth, and they wanted me to do some chanting for him. And so I went to the bedside. I was rushed as usual. Went to the bedside, he was in a coma, I started chanting. And I went on really on, so I could really chant, a really strong chant. And I was really giving it to him, a really strong chance he came out of the coma. He survived. And that's when I started getting into real trouble. People were really disappointed at me. Because they'd come from all the different parts, they'd taken time off work, they'd even already arranged a funeral service. And now they all had to go home and come back 6 months later or something when he died properly and cancel all the funeral arrangements, which were very expensive because this quite old monk did the wrong chanting because they really wanted like die peaceful chanting, not get well chanting. So because of that mistake, if ever you ask me for some blessings and some chanting that someone's getting married or they're having an operation, or they're having an exam or something, I have to ask these days. I learned my lesson. That when you do chanting as a monk, you always got to ask, what chanting do you want? Get better chanting or die peaceful chanting. There's a difference. So that's what I'm kind to my past. I let people know all my mistakes and tell them about it. Because then it's not a problem anymore. You're not obsessed with it. And as for the future, I'm kind to my future. Instead of saying, oh, something's going to go wrong. Oh, I'm going to sort of fall off a cliff. Oh, I'm going to sort of not wake up in the morning. Let's just be hopey. Looking at the future with a positive mind. That's called hope. That's positive. Looking at the future with a negative mind, that's what causes the problems. So, looking at the future with kindness. If everything goes okay, wonderful. If it doesn't go okay, wonderful. I'm so kind to my future. Whatever happens, I'm sure I'll be okay. That kindness to the future means the future's not a problem for me. I don't worry about it. And of course, I know that now is where my future is made. This is where I learn how to make good futures. When things go wrong, you learn so much from that. Even because I travel a lot. When even recently they said, you go to the United States, have you got any insurance? And I don't have travel insurance. Why not? I said, well, what do you need it for? If I get to the other end, if I sort of break a leg, I've got all these people, if I go to Hong Kong, I've got all these people, they would fight over who takes me to hospital. It's my turn, because I want to make the good karma. Now, you got the good karma last time, it's my turn. So, my good karma is all the kindness which I've shown over my life so far. Because I've shown kindness, that's my insurance policy. And I know wherever I go in the world, if anything happens to me, there'll be so many people who want to help. It's your family. If you've got a good family, your family is the best insurance policy. They're always there to look after you, care for you. And actually they want to look after you. They really delight in caring for you. But sometimes I wonder that maybe I should get sick more. So you can make better karma. I'm pretty selfish being healthy. Look at it a different way. I think many of you could understand that. Anyway, so that's how you're kind to the future and the past. And you find that, it's no problem. And then you can let it go much easier. And also you have this beautiful kindness towards this present moment. Just being here. And you're kind to this moment. If you are kind to things, they don't bite you. Snakes. I had snakes crawling all over you. And they never bite you. If you're kind to them. And just, I remember just, I was doing some chanting once, and this other monk, this French monk, I remember him, and he was doing the chanting, and then I could see there was a snake crawled up his back. And the snake's head just came up the back, just like level with his ear, and this monk could see at the corner of his eye that something was there, and he turned around, and the snake turned around. The snake and the monk were eyeballing one another. And neither knew what to do. Because, the snake wasn't after a meal. They can't eat a monk. And the monk was, didn't want to harm the snake, so I think very gently, I think it was on this side, he put his robe down so the snake would very gently fall down and just go somewhere else. Snakes would never harm you. So it's only if you trod on them or got afraid of them, only then they would sort of really hurt you and harm you. But you don't have to worry now, because this is like cold season, all the snakes are sleepy now. But you can ask Christina or Scotty that there is, oh, you remember Scotty, that dugite, who just lives around here somewhere. Yeah, 2 meters long, deadly. But this time of the year, they're all fast asleep, hibernating. They don't come out in the cold weather. And it's just a beautiful thing. He just slithers along, enjoying himself. And people have a look at him, and he slithers away. And it's just, he's so cool and chilled out in this place. So you don't have to worry about anything. Because even the snakes here are vegetarian. Where is the true home of the mind in meditation? Thank you very much. Aha, where is your mind? So, this is the little exercise. Are you happy now? If you're happy, put up your hand. Now, keep your hand up there with your index finger. Can you please point to that happiness for me? Locate it. Where is it? Come on. Where is it? Are we just imagining it? How come you can't locate it? For those of you holding a teddy bear, where's the teddy bear? You can see it and there, yeah, you can point to it. And those of you got spectacles, where's the spectacles? You can point to it. Why is it that things like happiness, love, depression, anger, those things are real, but can you point to it? And the answer is no, because those are the things which live in the mind, and the mind is not in the body. And now, this was the wisdom of one of my friends, his 6-year-old or 5-year-old daughter, grade 1 at school, was asked by the teacher, what's the biggest thing in the world? My daddy, said one little kid. No, no, an elephant. No, no, a mountain is the biggest thing in the world. And the daughter of one of my friends, a common friend to Bernard Carr and myself, and said, no, no, said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. Said, what do you mean? And he said, well, my eye can see her daddy and a mountain and so much more if all of that can fit into my eye. Brilliant! My eye must be the biggest thing in the world. And so it was such an amazing way of seeing things that he sent a little letter to me explaining that. And then I said, 9 out of 10, because your mind can see everything your eye can see. And things you'll never see in the real world, or you can imagine. It can hear real and imaginary sounds. It can smell, it can taste, it can feel real and imaginary sensations like phantom limbs, for example. And it can also know everything you will ever experience, everything you can ever experience, can fit into your mind. So your mind must be the biggest thing. I never said in the world. Because the world can be known by the mind, can fit into your mind. So the mind's a bigger sin. So you don't say, where is the mind? Because the world is in the mind. Not the mind is in the world. Different way of looking. That's really good stuff. I feel the most peace, stillness and gratitude when walking in the forest. I would like to do some meditating using nature as a way to cultivate loving kindness, compassion and gratitude. Could you give some instructions on how to do this, please? Take an umbrella, otherwise you'll get soaked. It's nice walking in the forest, but there's sometimes when it's good to walk in the forest, and it's sometimes at this time of the year, the forest, if it's a nice sunny day, brilliant. But sometimes the forest can be quite uncomfortable. It's one of the reasons why people built cities or towns or huts, because the forest can be inhospitable sometimes. In some times of the year, like the summertime, it's wonderful just walking in the forest and finding a nice little hut in the forest and enjoying it. But of course, always, you respect nature, but nature has not sort of, never really looks for you as its dinner. So remember that any animals in the forest are always more scared of you than you are of them. So you can actually, if you do sit in the forest on a nice warm afternoon, it's amazing just the animals which will come up. You know, one of the animals, in this part of Australia are emus. And emus is, they're such big, ungainly, flightless birds. And they're very fascinating to watch, but they're so scared of human beings, they usually scamper away. And before we built China Grove, there was a few emus in this area. And I remember this one, it was an Anagarika wearing white. He was a nice warm day sitting out in the forest, just a little bit to the west of here. And he sat perfectly still, and an emu came by. And these emus, they're huge animals. And this emu saw this person sitting perfectly still, and obviously wondered who this was, what it was. And so came right up to him, and with its like beak, sniffed him. And of course he never moved, and the emu just sniffed, and then went away. And it'd be wonderful if you had that on a camera, on a video, because that is so rare that such an animal would treat a human being that way. Because he was still, it was totally non-threatening. So the emu just came right up to him, sniffed him, and then off he went. So, it can be peace, stillness, and gratitude when you walk in the forest, but you can't walk forever. So it's one of the reasons why you come back and you take that peace and stillness which you found in the forest, keep it in your heart, and then you meditate with it, with your eyes closed. And that is most still, because all sights can be a little bit disturbing compared to silence and darkness. When all the sense of sight turns off and sound becomes still, and you're comfortably sitting inside your body, not walking, not going anywhere, just being here. So the forest is good, but in here is better. How to be okay with rejection and not make it personal and degrading to your personal worth. How to perceive yourself the same deserving as others. And love yourself as you love others. Oh, that's such an easy question. If you're rejected, wonderful, that's one less person you have to please in this world. It's so hard trying to live up to other people's expectations and they don't like you, and just good riddance. So it's the same, I always turn things around. That sometimes people like look at me and they say, you had a great degree, now look at you, how much money have you got? How much have you got invested for your retirement? They've got nothing. So how much do you earn? Nothing. I work 7 days every week, many hours a day, I don't get anything. And they look at me and said, I thought so, you're a loser. And whenever people call me a loser, I say, sadhu, 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 thank you for that wonderful compliment. You really understand what a meditator does. You know, you lose everything. You lose your past. You lose all the fear of your future. You lose your wanting and your jealousy and your conceit and your fear of others, what other people think of you. You lose everything. And the more you lose, the more free you are. Who needs a house? Who needs a car? Wherever I go, I've got a chauffeur, wherever I go. Somebody picks me up and gives me a lift. So that there's a different way of looking at things. And so, with rejection, they just, please reject me. Because you only need one or two good friends in life. And the most important thing you'll ever have in this world is yourself. If you're at ease with yourself, it ain't not perfect, but you know, I tell people all my stupid mistakes. And just to make sure that even a big famous monk, it's just still, I make errors sometimes. I used to say about the nuns' monastery. So you're going to, you know, sometimes the word is like bikunis. And are you going too interested in seeing bikinis? Oh, so and bikunis, not bikinis. You make silly mistakes like that and say, oh, that's really an interesting joke. Because apparently there's a very famous, apparently, TV show, children's show, because bananas in pyjamas. So if ever we need to raise any money, for we can always have a TV show, bikunis in... No, I better not go further than that. I'll get into bigger trouble. So, you don't call that rejection. And you know, sometimes when people do feel they're rejected, it's wonderful to know there's a place, there's a home for you. That's one of the things with opening the door of your heart, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. So a lot of times you can feel that rejection which people have in prisons. People are afraid of them. I mean, they've got reason to be afraid. These are violent people, rapists. And sometimes they've got nothing to lose. So, you know, there's ones who are in jail, they've got no fear of reoffending. They're already in jail. But you know, that was why that a few times I went in prisons, and this one occasion, there's many people who were being raped in this jail. Men being raped by the prisoners. And so the authorities, they gave me this like biro pen. And they said, this is not really a pen. This is what activates the alarm system. If you look on the ceiling, is what we told the prisoners are fire alarms. They're not fire alarms. If anyone attacks you, take your pen, point it at one of those alarms, press the top, the button. The alarm will go off, we'll know exactly where you are, and we'll come and save you. But don't tell any of the prisoners, it's secret. And number two, put it in your pocket. I said, come on, look, I've got a robe on, I haven't got a pocket. Don't put it anywhere. So as soon as I went into my class, these prisoners, there's this really big one, you know, the one sort of, he became a really good friend. And he took one look at me, sitting in the front, you know, meditator, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, you've got one of those security pens as well, have you? So much for top secret. And he looked at me, you know, really seriously. He said, do you think you can press that button on the top before I jumped you and raped you? I said, probably not. He said, no, you wouldn't be able to. I'm too fast. But I never felt afraid, because he saw I wasn't afraid. He said, but you don't have to worry at all. You've been so kind to us in this prison. If anyone tried that, there's six or seven guys here, would jump them first. You're safe. And I remember that. It was just such a beautiful thing, compliment. That because I was kind, and I saw much, I respected the people in prison. I saw beyond the crime which they did, which gave them their sentence. So there's a human being in there, a beautiful human being. And when I saw that, at last they could see it for themselves. Then they could start loving themselves, give themselves respect. So I felt so safe in that jail. Didn't need any pens. If anybody tried anything on me, half a dozen prisoners would be my bodyguards. So anyway, so but you saw just how they were rejected. Rejected from society. And then you get people rejected because there's something physically different. They may just look like Down syndrome, or autistic, or ADHD, or schizophrenic, or any other sort of disease, you know, which makes them look slightly different. And they get rejected. That just makes it so much worse. And so we accept. Come in. You can come into this meditation retreat. Somebody asks, we're meditation retreat. You know, who's barred from coming on a meditation retreat? Can you have LGBTQIA? Of course. You can come and meditate. What about people with schizophrenia? Yes. Autistic? Yes. ADHD? Yes. Yes, 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 yes. With the right type of instructions. And so everybody feels included. And just, you say, okay, we'll give you a chance. See what you can do. And so often people are so grateful to be included when most of life they're, you know, excluded and rejected. Just that amount of kindness. Actually, they thrive. And always, I have to have a good reason to reject someone. They usually acceptance first. Yeah, give it a try, see what happens. And just about most times I've never been let down. So, that's all about rejection. So, whoever rejects you is just really stupid. Why do they reject you? And a lot of times there's no real reason. Maybe afraid of you. Anyway. Somebody asked me this already. I earn money by cooking and selling food, not vegetarian. Is it bad karma? I don't kill the chicken, but I still use their meat. It depends. It's as long as you don't exploit people, you know, by sort of, what's that story? Not the chicken cross the road. Why did a piece of tofu cross the road? You know tofu, the soy protein. Why did a piece of tofu cross the road? To prove it wasn't chicken. That's a vegan joke. Some of the vegans told me that one. So it's not bad karma. It just depends, you know, what you do and what you do it for. If a jobless person, highly educated, that's me. I'm highly educated, I've got no job. I've got a different type of work. Has paid every effort to find a job but still cannot find one after a certain period of time, how can he let go? Easy. Look, you know, if you haven't got a job and you're highly educated, you put lots of effort to finding a job, isn't life telling you something? You're supposed to be a monk. The pay is terrible. But the communal feeling is really good. And what else is the retirement benefits? Out of this world. Relax to the max is a powerful mantra. Thank you. Yeah, it is that sometimes. And where that came from was, of course, the Ajahn Gunha, who actually pat snakes. Ajahn Gunha would always go, sabai, sabai, breathe in, sabai, breathe out, sabai. Which is not bad, but, you know, to try and make it more sort of Western. Relax. To the max. Because what it is pointing to, that most people don't sort of get meditation, because it's far too tight. I don't know if I've said yet, the simile of a guitar string. Imagine a guitar string, and you really stretch it tight. And then something hits it. Bing! It makes a loud sound. But imagine that same string, and you loosen the tension on both ends. So it's no longer under stress. You're letting go. And then something hits it. No sound at all. That is a great simile for resilience and the lack of resilience. Some people are so tight, so stressed, that something hits you and you get sick. Why is it that some people go and get flu or get bird flu and pony virus, what I had? You all know what pony virus is, don't you now? Pony virus? That's when, if you looked at any of the videos recently and I was coughing, that was actually what I had, pony virus. It makes you a little hoarse. Okay, if that didn't work, I was transiting in too many airports. And what do you catch at airports? Terminal illness. And what happens? What happens if you really die? What's the last part of your body which dies, which passes away, which shuts down at death? The last part which shuts down at death is the pupils of your eyes. Did you know that? Only pupils dilate. Pupils dilate. Okay. Dilate. Oh, yes, got it. But that is the even relaxed to the max. It's a bit quirky, it's funny. Relax. Because when it's funny, you remember it. The two things you remember, the funny ones and the very painful ones, the trauma ones. And I don't like so teaching by traumatizing you. It's much better by the fun, the joyful stuff. And relax the max. You can say that any time. When you're very tense, you just have an important meeting. You've got the results of your biopsy coming. Or you've got you've got to go for some, giving birth or something. What would you teach your daughter? She's about to have a baby. What do you teach her? Relax to the max. And out pops your grandchild. It's very easy to do, relax to the max. Because people are so tight and tense in our modern world. And that causes so many physical problems, so much performance failures. Far too tight. Relax to the max. Going to sleep at night. Relax to the max. Oh. And you fall fast asleep. Anyway, does Mara come and disturb the monks and nuns in Bodhinyana and Dhammasara monasteries? Please tell us some stories if you have any. People love stories. Like the idea of Mara, the Mara came to see the Buddha under the Bodhi tree to try and stop him getting enlightened. And tried every trick in the book, you know, because Mara was, or the Buddha was a male, trying to get nice dancing girls to try and sort of get Buddha to give up. Oh, then that didn't work. And where it really almost, well, it didn't really almost work, what they also tried was like power. They said, you don't need to be enlightened. You can do so many things. You can be like a monarch, an emperor, like a president or something. But a really good, honest president, you can do so much for the world. So, that's what sometimes people try and disturb you. They always, the thoughts of doing something good. But, there's nothing as good as like being still, being enlightened, being peaceful. Setting an example. So, does Mara come and disturb the monks and nuns in Bodhinyana and Dhammasara monastery? Not really, because it's one of the reasons why we built this city centre in the suburb of Mara, It's short for No Mara. That's where you're going on Friday to see the talk. In the suburb of No Mara. They've got an LA in front of it, No Lat Mara, because that's it. If any of you are from Singapore, you know they always say Nola. So that's what it means. No Lat Mara, there's No Mara. So that's why. No. It's just a sort of metaphor for temptation, or for, you know, sort of defilements, and they usually dress themselves up as something very useful. But instead of that, no. How to achieve a goal while balanced, not wanting in life. Achieving goal in life is sometimes satisfying, and it's kind of a motivation. Wanting is suffering. How to differentiate and balance. In the world, you can have some goals, but the real goal should not dominate just the path towards that goal. In other words, it's the process which is the most important part. Because otherwise, you know, you'd get a goal. And I've built so many monasteries. What happens when you build a monastery? You go build another one. And another one. It's not building monasteries. It's like how you build them. It's more important. You could raise money, but where does it go to? So you can sort of teach. But why are you teaching? It's not to, you know, be a big shot monk, whatever that means. But the goals in life, always recall that, what was it, that story, when I was at school, high school, starting to do well in school. And you do these O-levels, first of all. You know, many of you know the O-levels, the English system. And when I was studying for my O-levels, that's where my parents and teachers said, no, stop playing soccer, because I loved my soccer. And then if you stop playing soccer and stay at home and do your homework, do some more study, you know, then you pass your O-levels. And when you pass your O-levels, then you'll be happy. You'll be set. They're an important part of your education. So my goal was not enjoying myself anymore. My goal was actually to pass these O-levels. And so I really worked hard and I passed. Then what? A-levels. Have you ever noticed, if you pass an exam, you have to do another one afterwards? But if you fail them, then you're free. There's some truth in that. So, but anyway, I was, you know, my parents and my teachers, so I'd worked really hard in my A-levels. And at that time they said, stop, you know, chasing girls. Before I was chasing footballs. But, you know, another couple of years older, stop going to parties and dances and stuff. And so I did. Well, not totally, but did enough and really worked hard and did well in my A-levels. Then what? Am I happy now? Have I fulfilled my goals? No. Now you've got to go to university and do more exams. But if you get a good degree from Cambridge University, wow, you're set for life. Yeah, a fat lot of good a theoretical physics degree did me when I became a monk. Actually, it was quite useful, that whole thing, but that's not what I really mean, passing exams. So that's when I started to really wonder. All these people kept telling me, once, you know, you fulfill this goal, then you'll be happy. Because I saw so many other of my friends, elder friends, they finished university. Were they happy? Not really. They had to get a job. Oh, you get money now, that must be wonderful. So no, it's not, because they're saving up for something. Saving up for a car. Or then they, you know, they fall in love and then they get married. They've got to save up, you know, to get married. To get a little sort of place to live together and all the things necessary to start a life together. And then they usually get married. Remember this? You get sort of a little place to live together, just really in debt, and you think, just when I can pay off the mortgage or the home debts, then I'll be happy. And before you even get close to paying off the debts for buying your house, you have a kid. And then you think, okay, when they grow up and leave, then I can be happy. I can be free. And then you're getting so close to, you're getting so old, you start to say, oh, when I retire, then I can be happy. And then you start, you're not happy when you retire. And I know that because it's amazing how many elderly people come to monasteries and churches and temples when they're old. You know why? Because they think, when I die, then I'll be happy. The goal is always in the future. Do you have actually, a lot of times the goals are just, what is the word? They promise so much, and they're always unfaithful to what they promise. To win the lottery. To actually to get healthy. To actually to have the perfect relationship. To, I don't know, even when you think, when I get jhana enlightened, then I'll be happy. You're missing a lot of what enlightenment, even jhanas are. It's not when I get this, I'll get rid of that, then I'll be happy. There's only one place you'll find happiness and fulfillment, right here, right now, with what you've got. And then that becomes the jhana of enlightenment. Content, easily satisfied, at peace. And that transforms into bliss. When you're not doing anything, you don't need to do anything, you've got no goals. What's done is finished. Then you're free. This is, people always think that you've got to get rid of this, get rid of that, attain this and attain that to be happy. But you go that far for so many years, you never get anywhere. And one day you just say, okay, this is okay, this will do. This is good enough for me. And you sit down and do absolutely nothing. No goals, no aspirations, no wanting. And that's when enlightenment starts to happen. The end of wanting. There's two types of freedom in this world. The freedom of desire. To get what you want when you want it, to search and enjoy the search of striving for something. Because actually when you get the goal, when you reach the goal, it's you've lost something. You've lost the striving. Sometimes it's a journey which people crave for, not the success at the end. Because that is disappointing. Some Middle Eastern gentleman told me this years ago, said the two worst curses in the Middle East. The second worst curse, you know, at least it's got some class to it. It's not just, you know, get stuff or maybe drop dead or something. Whoever did this, you know, just really thought about it. So the second worst curse in the Middle East is, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. I don't know why that makes me laugh. I must be a sick monk. I need to go and see a therapist. But the worst curse is really deep. And I thought, whoever made up this curse really knows what they're doing. They said, may you get what you want as soon as you want it. That's a curse. Imagine that, every time you thought you wanted something, it suddenly appeared. Could you stand that? You can contemplate that. And that is, please excuse me, so much for Pure Land. People go crazy in Pure Land. Whatever they wanted, it comes straight away. Have you ever noticed that a lot of the pleasure of the human world is in working for something, striving for it. Even if you fail, then suddenly, you know, you manage to get something, you've achieved something. that pleasure of striving is very hard to give up. So if you already achieved something in life, you've got everything you want, you look for something else to achieve. That tightness and tension, what separates where you are from where you want to be. People crave that feeling. Which is why when they've got everything they want, what do you need anything more for? No, they're still addicted to the journey. Anyway, so I don't like goals in life. I have trouble sending metta to the people I do not care for. What should I do to be equanimous? Be equanimous? No, just send metta to the people I do not care for. Can you send metta to yourself? Is that because you don't care for yourself? Is the people who are sick, they're the ones who need the most medicine. So if you, the people you don't care for, they're the ones who need metta most. But if you can't care for them and send loving kindness when they're right in front of you, there's an old saying, to love the tiger but at a distance. Which makes a lot of sense. You don't go patting tigers unless you're an Ajahn Gunho or something. But after a while, sending metta to people you don't care for, at the end of the retreat you find how easy that is to do. Metta is like lighting a fire. When you light a fire, you don't light a fire by getting a match on a big wet sappy log. They will never take the flame. That's like trying to send loving kindness to people you don't care for. So start with loving kindness to people you do care for. Start with a teddy bear. So easy to send loving kindness towards a teddy bear. And then you can go from there to send loving kindness to a live teddy bear in a brown robe like me. Or somebody you're close to. Somebody like, it could be a cat or a dog. It could be some of the birds in the sky or the kangaroos you see. Send loving kindness to them. And then after a while, it's like you start with a match on paper. That takes the flame very easily. And then you put little twigs on it, kindling. And then you put bigger pieces of wood on it. So you build up the fuel slowly. You start with things which are easy to give metta towards. And then you build up a little bit harder to put metta towards. And when you have a big flat fire, it'll burn anything. So a little by little, when we do a sharing of loving kindness, we start with easy things. Make it a little bit more difficult, a little bit more difficult. When the flames and the heat is really building up, it's amazing. You can put anything on that fire and it burns. That's one of the reasons why the last thing we put on the fire is you. Amazing, because in our modern world, one of our biggest enemies is ourselves. But it can be like your boss or your ex or something. And it's so easy to put loving kindness on towards them when you've got a lot of loving kindness to give. Anyway, dear Ajahn, a small piece of iron made up of billions and billions of molecules, atoms, neutrons and protons. Each of these atoms are separate entities and they are so small that it gives the illusion of smooth surface. My question, what is it that bond these atoms together, considering each of these atoms are very far apart from each other? Please explain this in Buddhist terms. It is, when I was studying subatomic particle physics, it was quite clear it's not the stuff which is important, but what binds them together, or what pushes them apart, the four fundamental forces. That's what was there when I started, but two of those forces, you know, they were actually just manifestations of the same. The strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and gravity and electromagnetism. They found, I think, the weak nuclear force and electromagnetism were the same, but a different scale. So there's three main forces which actually bind stuff together, or push them apart. And those are the forces which, you know, you can say create those particles. It's the forces which make up this world, this universe, not the stuff on which they act. It's the greed, hatred and delusion which makes up this world, this mind. the forces, the current defilements, or the letting go, the kindness, the peace, the forgiveness, the renunciation. Those are the fundamental things of meditation. It's not the jhanas. It's that those are just what happens. It's just why they happen. The relationships between you, whatever you experience, that's where the action is. So this is where the relationships. It's not how good is your meditation, but what do you do with your meditation? What's your relationship with your breath? What's your relationship with your body? Are you a control freak? Or are you kind? Are you patient? And so success in meditation, success in life, is learning how to have a good relationship with failure, with pain, with success, with whatever happens to you in life. And whatever meditation object you're aware of, it's how you relate to it and deal with it. That's the most important part of life. We'll all have disappointments and successes, praise and blame, happiness and misery. That's the stuff of life. But how do you relate to that? What do you do with it? How do you deal with it? That is where wisdom and enlightenment work. Relationships, not stuff. Why is the world so unfair to allow the US, the already the strongest country, to institute unfair treatment attack to other countries? Is it really the strongest country in the world? Where would you like to live? Even does it have lots of stuff? I don't know how many people you see there are homeless in the United States who are begging on the streets of, you know, in California, a very rich place. So is that the best country in the world? Where would you like to live? A country which is rich, but afraid, where there's not enough kindness in the streets? Or would you rather live sort of in Jhana Grove, with monks who are really poor? Actually, we beg as well. But are kind and happy. Where would you like to live? So sometimes we look at these countries and say, oh, they're powerful, but are they really powerful? Really powerful people don't need to show their muscles and exert force. Really sort of wise people don't need to brag. Kind, powerful people or countries are those with lots of friends. How many friends does the United States have? There's the friendships, the community, which creates strength. I think the United States is the most worried nation in the world. I am worried that my father creates a lot of bad karma for himself. He's not a Buddhist, not religious, he is also stubborn and set in his ways. Is there anything I can do to help reduce his bad karma, generate good karma for him? How can one help a non-Buddhist prepare for eventual death? Oh, your father creates a lot of bad karma. I don't know what you mean, what he's doing to create a lot of bad karma, but sometimes we are owners of our karma, each one is an individual of our karma, but one nice thing you can do is to influence your father, not through words, by actions. Look at him, and any nice thing he does, celebrate it. And this is way we can actually influence other people, not by criticizing their bad actions, by making sure that their good actions are noticed and appreciated. So when your father does stupid things, like going to sort of get a sort of a China doll, or whatever, that's what people said, that's in Singapore, the word when you have a mistress. I don't know if that's what he's doing wrong with bad karma, or he's just going and just wasting the family fortune and in the casino or something, or playing mahjong all day, or drinking, whatever, I'm not sure. But every time he does something good, that's a very lovely thing you did, Dad. That's very kind. That was very marvelous. So it's always a positive reinforcement, reinforcing of the good stuff, and just forgetting about the bad stuff for a while. That's all you can really do. And when your father gets positive reinforcement, he likes the praise, he likes the fact that, you know, you smile at him, just, you know, when he does something good, then you find that you are changing him. He has that seed of goodness inside him, like everybody does. But you can't force him. The more you force him, the more he will resist. I try to apply kindfulness to my body in meditation, but to me it's like a concept. I think of kindfulness, but not really feeling it. Is this the right way? No, you've got to feel it. So how can you feel kindfulness? Please follow this little exercise. Put your hands out. Have a good stretch. And start bringing it in, and in, and in. Really get into it. Because it's so difficult to give someone a hug these days. Number one, they've got all these diseases. Oh, I should have said a communicable disease. It's contagious. Hepatitis B. Hope you heard that right. Not hepatitis. Hepatitis. Hepatitis Buddhism. It's communicable. Many people catch it from me. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You don't do that, you feel happy. Hepatitis B. What's the best blood group to have? I don't know what blood type you are. B positive. If you've got B positive blood, I mean, you're way ahead of the game when it comes to enlightenment. So anyway, that's one way of giving yourself a little hug. The other thing, because you're a religious person, you know, if I give somebody a hug, people have got, you know, all sorts of, what do you do that for? That's sexual assault. But you're a guy. Yeah, that doesn't matter these days. So a guy hugging a guy, or even a guy hugging a girl, and you go to jail for that sometimes. But anyway, you know, it's just totally just trying to be kind. It's sometimes really hard sometimes, that these days, that sometimes just being kind, like a teacher gets a kid at school, and, you know, they're having a really bad day, you just want to give them a hug of kindness and love. Nothing sexual about it, but you can't do that anymore because people have got so much doubt. What did you intend by that? What was your meaning? Obviously, we have to protect children and protect sexual assault, but there is something, you know, lost in that. You can't give somebody a hug. You know, in countries where just that's what's really necessary. Just because kids don't have time with their family or time with their parents. But anyway, that's the world we live in. So I know that I can't be hugged by anybody except by me. Right. And that is perfectly legal. They can't call me a sexually assault on myself. And whatever I've got, I catch anyway, so it doesn't really mean anything. So that's, I'm just hugging myself. This is quite good. Is mindfulness and awareness the same? Yep. Well, I'm trying to finish off the question. Is mindfulness and awareness, yeah, pretty much the same. Some years ago, I heard you saying in Hong Kong, I live in the real world. That stuck in my mind. I've been curious. How does the real world look like? It's like what the fake world looks like, first of all. I don't dye my hair. I don't, what else? You don't wear like, implants. I haven't had a nose job. This is actually how I am. And I notice when you go through airports these days, they're like shopping malls. And in the shopping malls, they've got fake smells, they've got fake stuff everywhere. And there's so much fake in this world. Even an aircon, you're not actually realizing just, you know, what real nature is like. Have you ever got wet in the rain? People are afraid of getting wet in the rain. You don't get dirty, just jump in a puddle and get mud all over you. That's like real, that's nature. You have a headache, you go and take a aspirin or something so you don't feel it. So are we living in a real world or a fake world? And even how many people die in our world? They don't die in our modern world. They go to the other side. They pass on. They go and meet their maker. They go and they're united with Auntie Jean, who passed away some years ago. But they don't die. So just sometimes there's a lot of fake and a lot of escape from the real world. It's okay to be sick. It's okay to die. It's okay to hurt. It's okay to make mistakes. You don't need to hide this. So sometimes in the real world, there's no pretense. There's no fake. As it is, that's how you live. Interesting. But anyway, this goes on a long talk now, and I want to finish in 3 minutes. My mind says, thinks differently to my heart. What should I do? Please advise. Your mind says differently to your heart is, really? Have a conversation with your mind and your heart and see if you can come to some, not sort of arguments, because sometimes that's like husband and wife arguing. Why do husbands and wife always argue? Because they don't listen to one another, that's why. If you listen to one another, it's so easy because both people want to do the same thing. What was it? There was, as cartoon, there was a husband and wife, and there was a big numeral written on the ground in the car park. And the husband would say, that's a 6. And I said, no, it's not a 6, it's a 9. No, it's a 6. No, it's a 9. You understand what they were doing? Just, if you look at a 9 from the tail, it looks like a 9. If you look at it from the fat part, it's a 6. They're both saying the same thing. Why do you want to argue with it? So sometimes if you move over to where your wife sees it, and the wife moves over to where the husband's seeing it, and the husband says, oh, actually, you were right, darling, it was a 6. And said, no, it's not, said the wife, it's a 9. Why do people do that? So let your mind and your heart, when they come together, your mind and your heart, you just are and you're kind. No more argument. Jaya Champaram Namaste. There was one time when I was in a sitting meditation, my body moved to another place when the meditation ends, and I could feel the movement throughout. It feels like I was circling the meditation hall. Another Bhatti told me that it was moha taking its form in my meditation. Oh my goodness. Sometimes, you know, why did something interesting happen and then they always put it down? It would be very kind if you could explain this experience to me. That you were sitting meditation and your body physically moved to another place when the meditation session ends. And I could feel movement throughout, or was it due to you physically moving, or you were levitating, or what were you up to? Levitation does happen. Very, very rare, and if it ever does happen, don't tell anybody. I'll finish off with this story, but I need more information to explain what this really is. And there was this monk in the forest, you know, he's a good monk, and he learned how to levitate, and, you know, he would just do his exercise every morning, you know, a few laps of the forest, and then, but then one day somebody saw him. What would you do if you saw somebody levitate? You'd tell other people. Hey, guess what? I saw a buggy on that monastery today, just one of the monks that was levitating. And then, really? Where? When? Who was it? Then you'd all want to see it. And that's what happened to this monk. The villagers started to find out his monk could levitate, so they went over there, and the people in town found out, and eventually got to the city when the king found out. He said, I want to see that as well. But of course the king didn't want to go travelling, so he sent one of his ministers, please invite that monk to come and visit the city, the palace. And now monks who levitate, and they're not interested in honours of fame or stuff, so they said, no, I'm happy in my forest, said the monk. So the next time, the king sent the army up there to invite the monk. And the king was quite kind and said, Look, I've built a nice forest for you in the grounds of the palace, a nice little hut there, and so you feel at home. I know that the previous king of Thailand built a little forest in the Chitlada Palace, and there was one of the monks who actually visited here, and when he heard I was in Thailand, they invited me there. It was Ajahn Leon. And it was amazing that in the big grounds of Chitlada Palace, where the previous king of Thailand lived, he built a little forest. And a tiny hut, just like you see in the forest monasteries of Thailand. And they even imported forest chickens there, so the forest monks would actually feel at home there. I don't know if they imported any mosquitoes but to feel at home, but anyway. And so the monk would live there. So this monk, the levitating monk, he was invited there, so it's the same, make the king happy, and so the king could make good karma, by feeding this monk and maybe get some advice on meditation. It was very good for the country, so the monk was very happy like that. And the monk would always do his, he was in the habit of the exercises, a couple of laps around the palace every morning. And according to this story, it's usually the servants or the king would bring the food to the monk. But this one morning, this monk was doing his early morning laps, and the palace sent one of the princesses, to feed the monk. And just like in Walt Disney, the princesses are always beautiful. They never have an ugly Cinderella or a princess. The stepsisters are always ugly. But the princesses are always beautiful. And so, the monk was actually just coming into land, and, he took one look at this princess. He had just one moment, lack of mindfulness. That's all it takes. And some lust came up. Some attraction. Some attachment. And at that tiny sort of defect in his mind, he lost his ability to levitate, to fly. And he had to do crash landing, which hurt. And that took away his ability to fly for many, actually years. And so that he had to sort of pack up his bag after his lunch, and he had to walk back to the forest, where he usually lived, away from the palace, and just realize the dangers of, the sensory world. And that's why these powers, these psychic powers, such as levitation, are just so sensitive. It's very dangerous. If you levitate, it's okay getting up, but what's going to happen when you get down? So, you have one bit of anger, one bit of lust, one bit of defilement, and then, I'm sorry, our insurance does not cover injury through levitation. So anyway, that's through levitation and through body moving and other stuff. So I'm not quite sure exactly what this experience was. But anyway, I thought I would end it with just a little story about flying through the air and levitation. And what would happen here? If you levitated in Australia, you get shot down as unidentified flying meditator. Okay. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And anyway, today, finished off. That's one. Thank you. But I'm sure there'll be more tomorrow. Very good. So I wish you all a happy night. And, I don't know, it's a bit chilly tonight, but you get used to it after a while. One of the nice things about being cold, in cold climates, you live long. You do. Proof of that, have a look in the freezer. When you put things in cold freezers or refrigerators, they don't go off. They don't expire. Okay, anyway, have a good night.
If you wish.